This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's FTX. It's a safe and easy way to get into crypto.
Yeah, I don't think so. And I'm never wrong about this stuff.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. And if you've been listening for a while now, you might know that for probably a year now, I've wanted to do a special series of episodes to explain and explore the profound political implications of the emerging financial tools and technologies and assets that are vaguely implied by the term crypto. Some of you have expressed a lot of interest in this topic. Still others of you might be thinking, don't bother me too much with crypto. I hope it goes away before I ever have to learn more about it. I've received messages to that effect. If you identify with that sentiment, I understand. But I would suggest that you may have been ill-served by the mostly simplistic and often dismissive coverage of this topic among major news media. So while I am planning a longer series of episodes that will begin with some fundamentals about money and currency, like its origin and evolution, properties and functions, and some of the fundamental themes driving this innovation, like privacy and the freedom to transact legally without government interference, the dollar as the global reserve currency, which has come up a few times on the podcast. This is not that series, but I am particularly excited about the conversation we're about to have because I think it will offer you a window into the disruptive power of emerging finance and the novel questions and turf wars that lawmakers and regulators and prosecutors are now facing as a result of this innovation in the context of an enormously consequential war of lobbyists and lawyers and PR firms and activists between Wall Street and Silicon Valley. So today we're going to talk about Sam Bankman-Fried and the collapse of what was one of the largest crypto exchanges in the world, FTX, and everything you need to understand about this story. To do that, I am lucky to have two good friends joining me today whose combined knowledge and expertise spans everything we're going to talk about today. Donna Riddell was the managing director of the World Economic Forum, and she was the first woman to chair a U.S. exchange, the Commodities Exchange. She's also a New York City-based advisor and investor focusing on fintech, blockchain, and emerging technologies. Donna also developed and teaches a course on blockchain, crypto, digital assets at Fordham Law School and the Fordham Gabelli Business School. She's also taught at the Wharton School at Penn and her alma mater, Columbia. She has a JD from Fordham Law School and an MBA from Columbia. Donna, it is my pleasure to welcome you to Politicology.
Just very, very happy to be here. And I'm looking forward to an exciting conversation, especially in the times we are at the moment.
We are also joined by Justin Weitz, a partner at the international law firm Morgan Lewis, where he specializes in white-collar criminal issues and government enforcement. Justin spent a decade at the Department of Justice with a focus on running and managing public corruption and complex financial fraud investigations and prosecutions. Over the last several years, Justin has spent quite a bit of time focused on cryptocurrency-related criminal investigations. Justin, it's great to have you here. Welcome to Politicology.
It is wonderful to be here.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Where do we begin here? On a really fundamental level, I think there are a lot of people who don't spend a lot of time thinking about this space, who assume that a cryptocurrency is a cryptocurrency. They might have different names, but that these tokens and coins all really operate functionally the same way and should be treated the same way. So, Donna, could you begin maybe by surveying the landscape of different digital assets, focusing on cryptocurrencies, since that's what we're concerned with here today, and in particular, highlight the difference between Bitcoin and crypto especially through the eyes of regulators. What do people need to know to access the conversation we're about to have?
So I would say that, of course, most people remember that Bitcoin was the first crypto and blockchain on a cryptocurrency that started way back in 2008. A white paper was published. And in 2009, the first bit of Bitcoin was mined. The fundamental difference about Bitcoin, it is capped, so they cannot have any inflation. It is completely decentralized. There's no supreme being or group of beings. Satoshi Nakamoto, who is the, quote, founder, people don't know whether he, she, or they, who they are. And it's not necessary to know who they are. It's much better, actually, to have it totally decentralized. But what it was a response to the complete collapse of the financial system globally in 2008, 2009. And what we saw again was central banks printing money. And actually, within one of the first blocks that Satoshi mined, he put the front page of the Financial Times, which talked about the printing of the money and the Bank of England. And so that was a commentary on the ability for central banks to inflate their currency, to protect their currency, to create more money, et cetera. And so that, I think, is like the most, Bitcoin is the, you know, granddaddy, as well as has different properties than the other coins. The other coins are spun up around protocols that do various kinds of decentralized finance, though for the most part, there's a lot of theater around their decentralization, and that we can go into a bit later. But it also allows Bitcoin the ability to self-custody. I mean, you can hold your own money. These are bearer instruments, which is something that the governments don't particularly like anymore for a number of reasons, including taxation. We can get into more of that as we get into the conversation. Hopefully that is a good level setting.
Justin, I think there's a misguided sense also that because what we're talking about is at the bleeding edge of innovation, that it is completely unregulated and that's there's a wild, wild west effect happening. There is some gray area, right? But the idea that these startups are running wild, they are completely unaccountable to existing law is not right either. So generally speaking, Donna just mentioned sort of the 2008 collapse, and then you have Bitcoin entering the scene right after that as a response to it. How has the emergence of these new financial assets and technologies impacted, changed the way white-collar law enforcement approaches this space, and specifically the intersection of technology and finance?
So it's important to put yourself in the shoes of law enforcement and prosecutors and people at the SEC and CFTC and other regulators in the way they were introduced to crypto and the way they think about it. The way in which crypto became a public topic, the way a lot of people in law enforcement and the SEC and the prosecutor community first heard about it, it wasn't the most positive unveiling. And what I mean by that is when I think crypto really first hit the scene as far as DOJ and the FBI and other parts of the government go really was about 10 years ago involving Silk Road. I think that was the first big crypto-related law enforcement or prosecution action.
And Silk Road, for everybody listening, was a black market essentially on the internet where you could buy and sell almost anything but pay for it in cryptocurrency.
Exactly. And Ross Ulbricht, who was convicted and sentenced to life in prison, who went by the name Dread Pirate Roberts, that in that case, there was a lot of bad stuff going on. There were hitmen being recruited, there was drugs, there was child porn, there was pretty much everything you could imagine. There were also side cases involving law enforcement agents who had stolen money, stolen crypto or stolen Bitcoin in the process of investigating those cases. And so that's the way that I think a lot of people in the FBI, at DOJ, and in the law enforcement community in general became introduced to crypto as this tool for being used for illegal activity. Now, we know that's not the only reason you use crypto, and frankly, it's not the reason that most people, the overwhelming majority, do.
Right, but that's, to your point, that's also the way most people were exposed to it, because those were the headlines, right? So we've come a long way since those days, but not only law enforcement, I think my parents also probably were exposed to this stuff in the same way, in the same context as the crimes and abuse.
I just wanted to, make sure that people understand that because these cryptos, and whether it's Bitcoin or other, are on a blockchain, they're relatively easy to track. And so in these, the DOJ and other law enforcement people will say that it's a much easier to track Bitcoin than it is cash. And these types of activities, no matter how nefarious they are, were happening and are happening, and people are transacting in other kinds of medium. And it's easier to catch them and to find them because of the crypto than other ways. And there are a number of very sophisticated companies, Chainalysis, Elliptic, just to mention a few, that work with governments, exchanges, et cetera, in doing this constant kind of tracking in order to be able to get the bad guys, albeit that it, you know, what Justin says is absolutely true. It came to people's attention in these kind of headline things.
Right. So it's evolved since then.
It has. And I mean, I think the point you make, Donna, is totally right. But early on, I think from the perspective of DOJ, it just sounded really, really shady, right? This idea that you have a blockchain, I think most people, and this is probably true as much as I love my former colleagues at DOJ, I think a lot of people there don't fully understand how a blockchain works and how cryptocurrency works. And they see it as this nefarious, this tool that's been used, and certainly it has been used, but by the way, so has cash, so have credit cards.
So has cash,
so
right.
A lot of other things for illegal purposes.
Yeah.
But to the degree that first impressions really matter, Silk Road is a really bad first impression for cryptocurrency.
This
to
is
make.
A political podcast. We know first impressions
it's
matter.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the coming down an escalator, if you would. but I'll just say it was a really bad first impression. And so I think the lens that a lot of people at the FBI, SEC, DOJ, all these other entities looked at crypto through was really negative. I don't think that's entirely the case right now, but it led to a view that we need to be rooting out wrongdoing and misconduct in the crypto space, which I think is a good thing. We all want illegal conduct to be rooted out. The second thing I'll just say very quickly in terms of the way that regulators and law enforcement look at this is DOJ, SEC, everyone is ambitious. Everybody wants to bring big cases. Crypto's gotten a ton of attention in the last 5 years. And so there's been competition among and within those agencies to bring big cases. And it means figuring out how to use contracts with Chainalysis and other consulting agencies to find crypto-related cases and really spend more time on cryptocurrency-related fraud and misconduct cases, sometimes to the exclusion of other things. And so what you're seeing in the media as a result is crypto case after crypto case after crypto case, because I do think DOJ and the SEC and the other agencies are focusing on crypto cases that I always call them magic beans cases.
They could be
anything, right? It could be somebody lying a Ponzi scheme or some other scheme where somebody's lying about anything. They could lie and say, I have magic beans, but the magic beans happen to be called magic beans coin. And so it becomes a crypto case and it's sexy and exciting. And as a result, it's all over the media. And that contributes to this cycle where everybody thinks that crypto is inherently a shady criminal enterprise.
Talking about all these agencies, the problem with them is that they do a lot of talking and they may bring cases, but what they haven't done is do the real work. They haven't sat down and said, okay, there's a new technology here. The new technology enables lots of privacy, it enables people to be able to custody their assets, enables them to be able to be more sophisticated or not. I mean, they could choose to do it or not do it. And so how are we going to approach this on a holistic basis to be able to not just squeeze it into the rules that currently exist, but also modify or adapt rules that currently exist or put new ones in that reflect the technology, the innovation, and not stifle it. And we are behind. The EU has a whole comprehensive set of rules. Brazil has comprehensive rules. Singapore, Dubai, UK just put out a whole, 400 pages of the things that they're thinking of doing for common. And we don't have that.
Okay, so we've now established the sort of landscape that this conversation is happening in. So you mentioned big cases, Justin. One of the biggest cases ever in this space is what we're talking about today, FTX. So for the 18 months before the collapse of FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried was all over Washington working with members of Congress and regulators. He was, you know, being talked about as the person who was going to take crypto mainstream, right? He's this wunderkind. FTX spent a ton of money on promotion. They had the naming rights to the Miami Heat's arena. They spent over $22 million on social display and video ads in the US in 2022. And that number doesn't include all the TV ads, Super Bowl or out of home or sports deals that they did. FTX and SBF became central figures in how people who hadn't paid attention to emerging finance became acquainted with it. So I want to take a minute to lay out the positioning of SBF as a figure and FTX in the landscape of the emerging financial industry. Donna, do you want to take the ball there?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you said, you have a wunderkind who is a combination of a personality and has some very good entree to Washington. Initially through, I believe it was his mother. Both of his parents are professors at Stanford Law, and his mother was very involved with the Democratic Party. And so he became somebody that was going to Capitol Hill a lot, raised a lot of money. We could talk about the money raising, et cetera, later on, to be able to start a global exchange and a U.S. exchange. A lot of the products that were offered in the global exchange were not offered in the U.S., because they don't comply with U.S. rules. But that doesn't mean that the global exchange, you know, was the second largest right behind Binance and grew very, very rapidly and was very involved. Also, it had a second part of it, which was a hedge fund called Alameda, which was making markets. And there's not a lot of Chinese walls between in exchanges between what is the market makers, the exchange, the customer money, clarity relating to what you can or you can't, the exchange can or can't do with that money. So at the same time that his persona is one of we want to play by the rules, behind the scene, as we've now found out, he was really kind of doing things that were blatantly, allegedly illegal.
So back in spring 2022, I was asked to present a discussion at Wake Forest University on the future of capitalism, a conference they were having on the future of capitalism. And the discussion I put together, Donna was part of that, and so was Mike Madrid, and we were talking about cryptocurrencies and democracy and the future of capitalism. And I remember while we were down there, at either one of the breakout sessions or it might have been before, right before the conference started, Donna, you showed me the transcript from this interview, which is now infamously referred to as the box interview or the black box interview. And I want to play two of the clips from that interview, which was on the Bloomberg podcast with Matt Levine and Sam Bankman-Fried and a couple of other co-hosts. So I've got two clips here. The whole exchange is about 10 minutes long, but I just pulled out two sections that are about 2 minutes in length each. And I want to play the first one for you now.
Can you give me an intuitive understanding of farming? I mean, like, to me, farming is like you sell some structured puts and collect premium, but perhaps there's a more sophisticated understanding than that.
Let me give you sort of like a toy model of it, which I actually think has a surprising amount of legitimacy for what farming could mean. You know, where do you start? You start with a company that builds a box. And in practice, this box, they probably dress it up to look like a life-changing, you know, world-altering protocol that's going to replace all the big banks in 38 days or whatever. Maybe for now, actually ignore what it does or pretend it does literally nothing. It's just a box. So what this protocol is, it's called Protocol X. It's a box and you can take a token, you can take Ethereum, you can put it in the box and you can take it out of the box. Like you put it into the box and you get like, you know, an IOU for having put it in the box and then you can redeem that IOU back out for the token. So far what we've described is the world's dumbest ETF or ADR or something like that. It doesn't do anything, but let you put things in it if you so chose. And then this protocol issues a token. We'll call it whatever, X token. And X token promises that anything cool that happens because of this box is going to ultimately be usable by, you know, governance vote of holders of the X tokens. They can vote on what to do with any proceeds or other cool things that happen from this bot. And of course, so far, we haven't exactly given a compelling reason for why there ever would be any proceeds from this box. But I don't know, you know, maybe there will be. That's sort of where you start. And then you say, all right, well, you got this box and you got X token, and the box protocol declares, or maybe votes by on-chain governance or, you know, something like that, that what they're going to do is they are going to take half of all the X tokens that will have reminted, maybe two-thirds of all effort X tokens, and they're going to give them away for free to everyone who uses the box. So anyone who goes, takes some money, puts it in the box, each day they're going to airdrop, you know, 1% of the X tokens pro rata amongst everyone who's put money in the box. That's for now what X token does. It gets given away to the box people. And now what happens? Well, X token has some market cap, right? It's probably not zero. Let's say it's, you know, $20 million market cap. And a bunch of arbitrage treasurers.
Wait, from like first principles, it should be zero, but okay.
Sure. Okay. I completely reasonable comment.
Okay. From like first principles, the market cap of this box should be zero. So I'm going to play another clip in a minute. This conversation builds towards something that is really, just really stunning he said it in public. But up to this point so far, Justin, through a prosecutor's eyes, how does this sound to you? Because what he's describing is exactly the way most of these protocols were being launched and monetized and capitalized and sold up until FTX collapsed. So this was normal at that time.
So I think that from a prosecutor's eyes, when you're thinking about criminal cases, it all comes down to criminal intent, right? And it's different from what the SEC has to prove in its enforcement actions. It's different from the way we all think about it. It's really about criminal intent and whether there was an intent to deceive or defraud. And throughout this whole process, I think one thing that struck me was, will they be able to show that Sam Bankman-Fried acted with an intent to defraud? Because to be totally candid, as this was unfolding, and we'll get eventually to the indictment and some of the developments since then, that I think made clear that DOJ probably has a pretty good shot of proving it. But there's an argument to be made. And I think what a lot of us probably thought when we heard this for the first time was, I don't know, is this intent to defraud, or is just this just somebody who is operating a risky business in which he's being completely candid about the risks and there's no real intent there. And that's what distinguishes a criminal case. I don't know when DOJ started the investigation of Sam Bankman-Fried. My suspicion is they were investigating him in some form prior to the collapse of FTX in November. But I don't think it was an investigation of this sort into what eventually transpired and what eventually was charged. And so a lot of people heard this at the time, and a lot of people looked at FTX over the course of the last year, 2 years really, and said, okay, he's being completely candid about this, and we don't see a problem. It was only when things started to collapse that it really became a criminal issue for him, and it became one very, very quickly.
Yeah.
A couple of things. Number one, what he was describing he was not there describing his own token, though it actually became very similar to what he did. Now, if we added on, Justin, since, you know, lawyers love hypos and professors hypos, if we added on the fact that here we have this box and we creating these tokens and me, you know, who has these, I'm manufacturing these tokens in the box, I, unbeknownst to you, create a market in these tokens. And every time that the token goes down in price, I buy up a lot of tokens. Why? Because I want the market to think there's a demand and I want to support the price. And so I am doing that. I won't put any words to what that is, but a prosecutor, you might. And I'm not disclosing to people that I'm doing that. The market dips, it goes back up. I use money to do that, you know, et cetera, or at my trading firm uses money to do that. And it's a very narrow market. And so therefore, not only am I doing that in the marketplace, but when I give you as an investor my balance sheet, these box tokens all of a sudden are worth substantially more than maybe if there was a more free market trading of it And all of a sudden, what might have been worth, maybe let's just say $100 million, appears to be worth $1 billion. Because as maybe Ron will then play in the second part of the clip, that's exactly what these box tokens happened to.
That's exactly right. And I also want to offer up for context that that as Sam is describing here, and the part of this that we're sort of cutting out just for time purposes, because it's a 10-minute long bit. The next clip I'm going to play is about 2 minutes. But at this time, people, it's including lots of VC money from Silicon Valley, is flooding into these protocols purely because they are yielding so much, such a high return that they can't get anywhere else. So I'm going to play this second clip, and this is what it sort of builds to.
You know, X tokens being given out each day, all these like sophisticated firms are like, huh, that's interesting. Like if the total amount of money in the box is $100 million, then it's going to yield $16 million this year in X tokens being given out for it. That's a 16% return. That's pretty good. We'll put a little bit more in, right? And maybe that happens until there are $200 million in the box. So, you know, sophisticated traders and or people on crypto Twitter or other sort of similar parties go and put $200 million in the box collectively, and they start getting these X tokens for it, right? And now all of a sudden, everyone's like, wow, people just decide to put $200 million in the box. This is a pretty cool box, right? Like this is a valuable box, as demonstrated by all the money that people have apparently decided should be in the box. And who are we to say that they're wrong about that? Like, you know, this is, I mean, boxes can be great. Look, I love boxes as much as the next guy, right? And so what happens now, all of a sudden people are kind of recalibrating. Like, well, $20 million, that's it. Like that market cap for this box. And it's been like 48 hours and it already has $200 million, including from like sophisticated players in it. They're like, come on, that's too low, right? Like, and they look at these ratios. TVL, total value locked in the box, you know, as a ratio to market cap of the box's token. And they're like, 10x, that's insane. 1x is the norm. And so then, you know, X token price goes way up and now it's a $130 million market cap token because of, you know, the bullishness of people's usage of the box. And now all of a sudden, of course, the smart money, it's like, oh, wow, like this thing's now yielding like 60% a year in X tokens. Of course, I'll take my 60% yield. Right. So they go, they pour another $300 million in the box and you get a site and then it goes to infinity and then everyone makes money.
I think of myself as like a fairly cynical person. And
yep.
That was so much more cynical
than how
I would have described farming. Like, you're just like, well, I'm in the Ponzi business and it's pretty good.
Did any of this require any sort of like economic case? It's just like, other people right. put money in the box, and so I'm going to too. And then it's more valuable, so I'm going to put more money in. And at no point in the cycle did it seem to like describe any sort of like economic purpose.
Okay, so clearly we ought to be in the box business because apparently that's the way to do it. So I play all of this because in a minute we're going to talk about, well, what happened then to FTX, right? What catalyzed their downfall? What led to the collapse? But I play all of this because Donna, as you sent me the transcript and we were looking at it together, we were down at Wake Forest, your eyes just like bugged out of your head. I can't believe he said this in public. I can't actually believe his lawyers let him say this. Why did that strike you?
Well, first of all, like he does not listen to his lawyers, and you know who knows where they were.
Very clear.
You know, he was very candid about it. And clearly the way he framed it, and Matt Levine being both formerly at Goldman and a lawyer, could, you know, see right through it. He's very clever, very smart, and very an amazing writer. And you know, SBF did not even object to the categorization of it as a Ponzi scheme. Now, I'm not sure he believed at that point he was in that business. He was fundamentally in the exchange business, albeit that he had this FTT coin. But he was, you know, in theory, not in the coin creation business, though he backed a lot of coins. We put on the side his coin. So, yeah, he was just describing what was going on at the time with these box tokens and also the VCs that were making enormous returns from money that they put in and the liquidity of these tokens. So the time frame in which they were realizing return on investments instead of the kind of standard, I put some money in a company, maybe in 5 years, they have a buyout or they go public or something like that. It was you getting return on your investment within a year because you had all of these tokens that were liquid. And, you know, as soon as they could, you could unlock them in accordance with whatever, you know, kind of laws existed for accredited investors and the ability to do all that, you sold them.
Yeah. So the way I like to think about this is whoever makes the prettiest box makes the most popular box, and the most popular box gets the most money put in it. And the box with the most money put in it yields the most money because the money just keeps coming to the popular box. Justin,
until the box is popular.
Remember what
right, until it's not popular anymore. So is that illegal?
Remember what I said about magic beans?
Yeah.
So the question of whether it's legal, by the way, this is not legal advice.
Sure,
as Matt Levine likes to say.
And this is also not financial advice, yes, by the way.
This is not legal advice. I'm not your lawyer. Right. If you have a box that you're looking to market, please find a lawyer who knows what they're talking about.
Right.
Whether it's illegal, I mean, where the illegality comes is from two principal places. One, are you being completely truthful about it? If you are being completely truthful about it, you know, fraud as a general concept involves lying to get money. Misstating something, misrepresenting something, omitting something that you need to say, that you have an obligation to tell somebody. If you're being completely upfront and straight about your box, it may not be fraud. It may not be illegal.
The structure of a Ponzi scheme isn't inherently criminal, technically.
In theory, and I can't imagine a Ponzi scheme that could work this way, if you were completely upfront with your investors that what we're running here is a Ponzi scheme and there's going to be X amount of money, and if you don't get out when the music stops, you're going to be out your money, and everybody says, great, we knew that and we got into it, I think you'd have a really tough criminal case as a prosecutor.
Should I make a cheap shot about Social Security?
No, definitely no comment on that one.
But if we circle back to the regulators, it's not helpful, for example, after FTX implodes, that the SEC says, wow, I think that FTT token is a security. Like, seriously? By then, what's the point? You know, the question is that before you have it, and it's not as if there hadn't been any exchanges along the way that had problems. It's not as if bankruptcy people hadn't been talking about, if it's not your keys, meaning if it's on your, if your crypto is on a in custody on an exchange, it's not your crypto. It's not, none of these things, whether it was FTX or Celsius or Voyager or BlockFi, these are, you know, lots and lots of names, Terra Luna, et cetera. These were around. And so even just today, I mean, actually yesterday, the SEC to bring a case against Doquan and Terra Luna is somewhat of a joke, because they could have stopped something earlier on when they made a big deal and flexed a lot of muscles that they went to a conference and gave him a subpoena. That was in October of 21, which was many, many months before it imploded. I think it was April, May of 22.
Right.
And so the fact that a regulator is doing these things after the fact without a clarity of regulation before the fact is really where the problem is at this point.
So we'll get to the regulatory clarity in a bit, but first I want to talk about what happened next. And Donna, maybe you can walk us through, why did FTX collapse? Given that we've just set the stage with what was going on behind the scenes, at least with yield farming, right, and the Ponzi scheme, without commentary on whether it was legal or not, what happened next, and how did it happen so quickly with FTX?
Well, there were a series of events actually that happened somewhat prior to the FTX collapse that I just referred to, which was started. You know, there was Terra Luna, which was a maybe stable coin that wasn't a stable coin. It was anyway. And that collapsed in April, May of 2022. A lot of people had been involved, many, many people in Asia, not to say that there weren't a lot of people in the US as well, but had been involved in that ecosystem. Again, there was a Ponzi scheme there, mostly Anchor, which was one of these boxes. And so that came down. With it, it brought a number of institutional players that had been highly leveraged and all doing the same trade for the most part. That brought down 3AC, which was a big company. They all had also been using as collateral Grayscale, Bitcoin Trust. And so you saw the unraveling of some of the leverage that was there, BlockFi, Celsius, which is clearly a Ponzi scheme. And that brought us basically to the summer. FTX, nobody really knew was in any problems. They had raised some decent money during the bull market of 2022. And so, you know, people thought that they had a good trading arm, Alameda, and that they were doing a lot of good business, et cetera. But it's only so long you can continue to prop up what was going on. The interesting thing is that some of the pressure and public persona that SBF had is part of the reason of the downfall. He got very involved in the Stabenow bill. The Stabenow bill had some provisions in it that were specifically aimed at DeFi, decentralized finance protocols, in which there was an attempt to create the same type of regulation that would exist for an exchange like an FTX. They're very different animals. And so Twitter, which is a way that a lot of the crypto world and other people engage with it, Sam wrote a big long post about his theory on regulation, which then ended up with Eric Van Horst, who's an incredibly smart libertarian, wonderful Bitcoiner and writer. He engaged with Sam on Twitter, and on a Sunday night, they had a debate. And it was it's a fantastic debate. I point all of your, and if you do show notes, put the debate in your show notes, in which he basically, you know, kind of won the debate. Thereafter, that was on a Sunday. By Thursday, somebody had leaked to CoinDesk the balance sheet of Alameda. The balance sheet of Alameda showed these FTT, these box tokens, that were the biggest asset within their balance sheet. And that was the first look. By the next Sunday, a CZ of Binance, who had been an early investor in FTX, had said, you know, I've gotten out of some of my position in FTX and the equity. It's time for me to clean up the rest. And he was going to sell his tokens. He was also supposedly quite annoyed at some negative remarks about him by SBF relating to whether or not he was allowed to come to Washington. Many people interpret that different ways. I'll let everyone interpret it their own way. And so he said he was going to sell those. The person that was then running Alameda, who was Caroline, she said that she would buy it all at 22. Now, that's a very bad poker move, because now the whole world knows that the support level for you for that token is 22, which would mean for any of the loans that were collateralized, it was 22. CZ replied and said, thank you very much, but I will let the market do its work. And then he started to sell the tokens. Of course, the Alameda, SBF and others started to try and support that token, trying to buy it, as we talked before, to support the price of that token, until actually they had no more money to do that. The token collapsed, and then it was a matter of time until everything else kind of went under.
So is it fair to say in summation, right, that CZ, who's the head of this major competitor exchange, Binance, says, I'm going to sell off all my tokens, and that the tokens that he's going to sell are the box tokens we were discussing earlier. And that made a lot of other people antsy. So there was a run on the bank, and people were trying to withdraw more money than FTX had to give back to them, right?
That's absolutely correct.
So they had $5 billion in withdrawals that same day. $5 billion with a B. And this run on the bank really revealed that FTX had, you know, moved at least $4 billion from FTX to Alameda, as you mentioned, their trading arm. That's according to Reuters. The Wall Street Journal reported FTX lent more than half of its $16 billion in customer funds to Alameda in total. November 11th, I should say, FTX had filed bankruptcy for FTX, FTX.us, and Alameda. And then by December 12th, SBF was arrested in the Bahamas at the request of the U.S. government on charges that included wire fraud and conspiracy to defraud investors. And Justin, that brings us to the criminal case. Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. And make sure you're subscribed so you get notified when the second part of this conversation drops next week. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.